This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Annabel Rosa was always drawn to mainland United States as a girl growing up in Puerto Rico. I mean, as a teenager, she gave up her quinceañera for a trip to New York, came to the U.S. for college, stayed for about two decades. But then Annabel tried to live on the island again, pulled back to her roots in Puerto Rico. She just wasn't able to stay, found herself caught in the complicated relationship between Puerto Rico and the U.S. government. Today, Annabel Rosa is an attorney with a firm in North Carolina, also the chair of Durham Mayor's Hispanic Latino Committee, and a member of the Governor's Advisory Council on Hispanic Latino Affairs. Welcome back, Annabel. Good to have you here.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I hope you are. Talk about growing up. You grew up in a small community about 30 minutes outside San Juan, is that right?
That's right, Vega Alta.
What was that like?
It was wonderful. I have very happy memories of a very happy childhood.
Talk about the town and kind of what it was like and where you
lived. We still had a lot of sugar cane when I was a kid, and suburbs were being built. Mm-hmm. So we were free to roam around, ride our bikes, and come home when the sun came down type of thing. We didn't have... We were not addicted to tablets and things like that back then. So I have a lot of scars in my knees from doing a lot of fun stuff.
Education very important, obviously, to your family. But your mother didn't push it on you, is that right?
No, but I learned from watching her. She was going to college when I was still 6 years old, and she was doing her master's in social work. And she did that all on her own because money was tight when she was growing up, and only the boys were sent to college. So she had to do that on her own, and I just watched her and learned.
I wondered if it was unusual for a woman of her generation to have a college education, to say nothing of an advanced degree. How unusual was it?
It was. I remember going to college with her a couple of times when there was no one to take care of us, and she drove a Volkswagen with holes in it. We could see the road. unusual, definitely, having a master's degree.
What was she saying about that? And did it earn her any contempt, or did people look askance at a woman who'd be doing this kind of thing, especially with a family?
I think she was mostly... It was admirable, I think, to most. I think it's surprising to her own father. But definitely, I don't remember people saying anything negative. She, though, like we usually do, mothers, says sometimes, she will say, you know, I think I might have worked too much. I should have been home with you guys more often. But I don't feel that way. I'm very proud of what I saw her doing.
What did that mean for you as a family? Because it would mean taking on other roles that maybe you wouldn't have had to do. What was it like for you to have to pick up some of that?
My mother was a rare, awesome gift in so many ways. She was working as a teacher for adults. She was teaching math when she was really young. And she would do things like she brought somebody to live at home with us for 8 years. Excuse me, because the bus did not reach where this girl lived. We sometimes went around actually home to home because she wanted to gather up funds for somebody who had cancer. So she was rare, but awesome.
I guess so. And you are there living with her, learning by this example, obviously in awe of her, but also with an eye toward the mainland, mainland U.S. What attracted you?
So my father had lived in New York. I'm sorry. My father had lived in New York when he came back from the Korean War before he met my mother. And so I have two brothers who are living in New York, and we had a really good relationship because this, you know, was a previous relationship of my father's. But we all got along really well. And I wanted to go to New York. I was drawn by how, you know, New York, not everyone's Puerto Rican. There's Puerto Ricans and Jewish and African American. And so I was drawn by the culture and the grandiosity of it all.
So much so that you even gave up your quinceañera at 15. You said, could I take the money and put it into a trip to New York? Is that what happened?
Yes. And they said yes right away. They did not think much of that. They were like, okay, you go with your brother. It was awesome.
How long were you there?
I spent the summer there, maybe a month and a half.
So it didn't disappoint you?
No. I remember being on the street and playing around. There was always a bunch of kids and, you know, in the stoop and the water hydrant going off. And I just, you know, this was so different than what I was used to. But I was watching in awe.
Did you make up your mind at that time that you wanted to live there or not? Not quite then.
No, but the seed was planted. When it came time to go to college, I knew I wanted to learn English, and I knew that I wanted to expand my horizons beyond the island. Because an island, Puerto Rico is small. It's 100 miles per 35 miles, so it's this very small space, and I knew the world was a lot bigger than that.
You got a free ride to the University of Puerto Rico, right?
Yes, and I gave that up.
Where'd you go?
I went to Syracuse University.
Mm-hmm. What did you study?
I studied electronic journalism. I was in the television production program at Newhouse.
You also got involved politically. You became active, right?
Yes. We took over. I was protesting at a very young age, and we took over the Quad because we did not want Syracuse to be investing in South Africa because of apartheid.
And what drew you to electronic media, to journalism?
I thought about all the different things that I could get involved with. I was doing extremely well in school. My grades were very good. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I could do anything with these grades. And I thought, what would I enjoy? And I was a good writer. I thought journalism would be my fit.
Now, when you got to Syracuse, how much English did you know?
I knew English like you would know from maybe Rosetta Stone. I just read. I could read my biology books and my chemistry books, science books were in English. And I learned English. You had to take English in Puerto Rico from the time you're in second grade. So you know English like, how are you doing today?
Right. It's so nice. Conjugate a verb.
That's
you
right.
You can't always talk, right?
Yeah, but yeah. The way I learned that people spoke, you know, slang. Yeah. I could not understand it. So there was much that I would miss in a conversation.
You had to record your lectures, is that right?
Yes, I came up with I devised a way to be able to compete with the English speakers because I saw them taking notes. And at the end of the day, I knew I was in trouble. My very first lectures, yeah. I said, If I'm unable to take notes, I'm not going to be able to pass. And I was like Hamilton, not going to throw away my shot. so I was going to come up with a way. And what I did was I asked every teacher, can I record my classes? Will you give me permission? And some of them said no at the beginning, but then They each of them said yes, and I recorded them, and I left blanks. I would actually write blanks where I couldn't follow, and then at the end of the day, I would fill in the blanks with my recorder. So by the time that I finished my notes, I knew them by heart, and I did not have to study so hard.
Yeah, you listen to it 2 and 3 and 4 times, right? You're listening more closely maybe than the average student. Well, that's good. And what did you do after you graduated?
I stayed in Syracuse and I taught Spanish 101 and 102 and actually got a master's for free. So I took the opportunity to do that, and I loved literature, so I have a master's in literature. And then after that, I I still wanted to go to New York. I did not. I was not ready to go back to Puerto Rico.
Or stay in Syracuse. So what did you do in New York?
I looked for a production job, but there were not a lot of production jobs available. And I had a friend, a Dominican friend, who let me stay at her house. I basically stayed in her closet. Her parents let me stay in this little room, which I shared with a parrot.
You and the parrot somewhere in New York.
So I sent out resumes every day, and I was offered a job as a television reporter for a Spanish station. And I was not interested in being on television, but I said, this is my dream job. Thank you so much. I can get out of this closet. And
leave the parrot behind.
Yes, I did not say that part when I took the job, but I was very happy to have a job, a paying job that would get me out of the closet.
We'll talk about life after the closet and the parrot with Annabel Rosa. Also talk about your connection with then Mayor Dinkins and the rest of her career. Annabel Rosa, attorney with a law firm in North Carolina, chair of the Durham Mayor's Hispanic Latino Committee, and a member of Governor's Advisory Council on Hispanic Latino Affairs. Our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Annabel Rosa is caught in the complicated relationship between the U.S. government and the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. She grew up on the island, came to the mainland for college, stayed for two decades, tried to go back to live in Puerto Rico, but the economy was too tough and there were other problems, too, that made it hard for her to stay. Today, Annabel is a lawyer, very happy in North Carolina, but her first career, as she was telling us just before the break, was in TV news. Tell us about your first job as a TV reporter.
I'm not a television person. I'm not into makeup and hair. I wanted very much to be involved in picking up the stories and working them out and developing them, but I'm not a television personality. But I did a good job, and I actually was offered a job with a television station in California. After that, but I enjoyed going around New York City.
Yeah, you got access. You get to go to places and ask rude questions. That's half the fun of this game, isn't it?
This is true.
To ask rude questions. What kinds of stories were you doing?
Mostly political. I was sent to talk to legislators and the governor and people who were running for office at the time.
And you said it was a Spanish language station.
Yes.
So now this is a particular point of view. That's interesting to try to reflect. And again, multiple Spanish populations, Hispanic, Latino populations. You're from Puerto Rico, but your listenership is from all over, right?
It's Dominican, Honduran, Mexican. At that point, mostly Puerto Rican and Dominican in New York City.
So how did you frame what issues were important to you as a station?
It was mostly education. I think the things that concern everyone, except with a Latino bent.
Yeah.
Interestingly, that's the same thing that I'm doing now in North Carolina. It feels like history repeating itself. Because even in New York, things sort of cycle and tend to come around. So issues of interest to the Latino community, also in disseminating culture, because it's not always negative. Mm. We also wanted to showcase the different communities and backgrounds and the so much that we bring into the arts and to music.
Right. And as you say, I mean, education and economic development are important to everybody. And of course, the better that is for everybody, the fewer kinds of conflicts you have around issues like immigration and all the rest. We're going to talk more about that in a bit, but you, part of your job, you got to interview David Dinkins, who was then the mayor of, or running for mayor, I guess.
Running for mayor. I did not know that he was running for mayor. He wasn't sure that he would be running for mayor. He was looking into running for mayor at the time. He was the president of the borough of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But shortly after I met him, he became a candidate.
And he asked you to work for him.
This is correct. And I was so happy. I thought the job was such a perfect fit because I would be running the Latino press. But I also had an American education, an English education, mm-hmm. so I could also handle every aspect of press.
So what kinds of things were you doing?
I would do everything from writing a speech to fielding questions from the press. Eventually, I sort of shadowed him. So I would be with him all day long from the beginning of the day until the night. And I would be in the advance team. I would get there before he would get there. So by the time he would arrive to any location, I would know what anybody wanted to know about anything. And I would let him know what everybody wanted to know and what the answer was. And if I couldn't find the answer, I would tell him who knew the answer.
What? So you were in your 20s at this point, right? So
yes.
You're young, you're working, it's an exciting place, New York City, David Dinkins, he's going to run for mayor. But it's also kind of narrow casting in a lot of ways. You are shaping it in order to help one particular candidate win. Was there any tension in that? Again, shaping these answers, shaping the questions, helping somebody win. Did you ever have moments where you say, well, wait a minute, I'm not sure this person has got everything?
No,
As
I got to know him, I already liked him before I met him. I know that the movement that got him elected was tied to Jesse Jackson running for president, and it was called the Rainbow Coalition. This group realized in trying to get, well, they knew, I believe that they knew that Jesse Jackson would not become president when he was running, but the Rainbow Coalition was able to get minorities united, and from the numbers, from everything that was left after the election, there was a realization that a local politician could actually do this. Mm-hmm. Somebody at the local level, which when you look at the budget of New York City, and at that point it was the third largest budget in the nation, is no small feat. This was a realization, and it was so true, because even though we were all looking at each other and almost touching each other like, this is, we're not dreaming, right? He won.
This is a black man who's going to be elected president, mayor of New York City, right?
Yeah. And he did.
Yeah. So you loved that job. Could you have stayed on?
Yes, I could have. It was really hard leaving the mayor's office because he had not finished his term. And I was able to go to like 3 Grammy Award ceremonies, fly a helicopter over the marathon. Who can do that? Yeah. And especially this kid from Vega Alta, who, you know, it was really a dream come true. So leaving that to go to law school was a tough decision, but I do not regret it.
Why? Why'd you want to go to law school?
Well, I was with the mayor in Boston for a political trip. Not sure exactly what it was for, but we were in Boston and we were flying over the Boston Harbor. And he said to me, and I, at this point I've been working with him for a while, and he's like my grandfather. And he says, Annabelle, this is where the Boston Tea Party happened. And he pointed to the water. And I said, I know you're talking about American politics and American history, but I learned American history from a bunch of nuns from Spain And I'm missing,
I know. A bunch of nuns from Spain.
Yes, I went to Catholic school in Puerto Rico, and there was a quarter of a semester dedicated to American history. And I said, I have to tell you, I've been thinking about going to law school and learning the American Constitution. And he said, then you have to do it. And that's how that happened.
You did, and then you went to, where'd you go to law school?
I went to Brooklyn Law School, and I worked during the week because I had to support myself while doing this. So I went to Brooklyn Law School and worked.
And you worked for a law firm at a certain point. Was that after you graduated, or were you working for the firm getting through law school?
I was working for the firm going through law school. I was not considered a night student, but I pretty much became a night student.
Now, it's one good way to learn American history and American law, become a lawyer, but then you have to do something with it. What were your plans? What were you going to do with that degree?
I was fascinated by the Constitution and the political process, and I thought, since I had to consult with an attorney so many times when I was speaking with the press, I said, I could do this myself. And I thought I may go back to doing press work, but that I would have the law degree under my belt. But then I became fascinated with civil rights and started thinking, you know, maybe being a lawyer would be even better.
You stayed with that law firm. I think it was O'Dwyer and Bernstein,
yes.
Right? And afterward. But then things changed. You had a son.
I had my son, and I wanted to, then, you know, your life changes when you have a child. Your mom, your everything in you that says mom becomes activated, and I wanted him to have a backyard and the same roads that I had to ride my bike and all of that. So I started thinking about, you know, providing that, and unfortunately, after that, we had 911. We had 9/11 happen. So a lot of things happened that kept me out of the city. I think emotionally, I did not want to go back to New York City for a while.
You eventually came to North Carolina. You're here now. What drew you to North Carolina?
Well, from after 9/11, we left after 9/11. We left New York and went to Puerto Rico to spend some time with my mom. My father had just passed. And we just wanted to take some time off from New York. Ended up staying in Puerto Rico for 6 years. We wanted to be there for 2 months, but ended up being in Puerto Rico for a long time.
Now, at this point, who's we?
Well, my husband, my children, and I.
Got two boys, right?
No, I have a boy and a
boy
girl.
Boy and a girl, okay.
Yes.
And so now, and what are their ages at this point when you were there?
My son, at that point, my son was 4 and my daughter was 7 months, 6 months, seven
okay.
months.
So you're going to go and you're going home. Your husband is?
He does commercial construction.
Not from Puerto Rico.
He's Puerto Rican. I say he's Puerto Rican. He's from New York, but made with all Puerto Rican parts.
There you go. So what was it like going back?
Going back to Puerto Rico was awesome. You dream the things that you dream of because you never want to leave home. Mm. You never want to leave your parents. You never want to leave your roots. So going back was wonderful. And also, I kept thinking how my children would be in touch with their roots.
Yeah.
So in many ways, even though we did not plan to stay in Puerto Rico for that long, it really was a great idea.
Well, part of what happened with that idea and the conflict was you talked about your children's roots, but since they really weren't rooted on that island, they ran into some trouble, the converse of what they found on the mainland, right?
That's right. They were too American to be Puerto Rican and too Puerto Rican to be American. And I guess they're going to have to live with that they're going to go in and out of those spaces for the rest of their lives.
Well, talk about what that means, you know, on the mainland for them. In other words, how they experienced being too Puerto Rican on the mainland and how they experienced being too American, as you say, on the island.
Well, actually, when we came back to, when we decided to leave Puerto Rico and come to North Carolina, my son was bullied in North Carolina in middle school for being Hispanic. There was no difference as to where he was from, but he was followed by a group. I hope he forgives me for saying this, but he was followed by a group of kids that called themselves the Border Patrol. And they harassed him pretty much for a while, and he did not, I knew that I could do a lot of things legally, and I tried to do a lot of things administratively, but he did not want to sue anybody or pursue it in criminal court.
And then when you get to Puerto Rico?
And when we were in Puerto Rico, he was too American, so in a different way, he was also singled out for not being the same as everybody else because he spoke English mostly and his ways were not the local ways.
So you talked about this. It's interesting to hear how you make the distinction. You said too American to be Puerto Rican, too Puerto Rican to be American. But of course, Puerto Rico is America. It's a territory. When you use that, when it's used on the island, how do you and people born on the island navigate this idea of Americanness, being American?
It's, you know, this is what I live.
Yeah.
This is my existence. I am, in so many ways, whatever somebody thinks I am for the time that I am, do I come from a country? Is it a country? Is it a state? No, but it is treated as each person would think it fits them best,
right.
And in a way that also applies to how my children feel or who they are or who they choose to be. We feel very much Puerto Rican, but I was surprised to know the other day I went to speak to a group of people and they did not know that Puerto Ricans are citizens of the United
right.
States. They did not
right.
know that until Maria happened. So,
well, a lot of people don't know that still. So I mean, it's fascinating to even hear that kind of a distinction. I mean, you can think about, it is interesting to me. I want to talk to you more about this right here because, I mean, you think about what Garrison Keillor has done, right? He creates this place up in Minnesota where it is a very distinct culture. It becomes popular and wildly successful because if you're there, you recognize it. But most people who were his fans weren't there. And they loved it because they were looking at a very separate culture. But nobody ever thought that Minnesotans weren't American.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously a very different place. Puerto Rico, a very different place, a different culture. And yet you have to make this distinction between America and Puerto Rico. It seems to me a whole other level of trying to identify. It's not just a cultural distinction. It becomes an important political distinction. And certainly with an event like Maria, we can see it. The aid doesn't flow the same way. It doesn't get there at the same time. And there are issues of corruption on the island that perhaps would not be tolerated on the mainland.
And traveling, if I live in Puerto Rico, cannot vote for the president. And if I am here, I can. And there are certain tax implications that change if I am a resident there or if I'm a resident here. So that is surreal.
Wow. So what happened? You were there for a while, but ultimately you found that it was just untenable. Couldn't stay.
Yes. When there was a downward spiral with the economy, I believe it started in 2004, around 2005. And when the economy hit us so hard in mainland, it hit Puerto Rico 10 times harder. So I was doing well. I was handling cases in federal court, enjoying myself, doing that every day. My husband's work in construction pretty much came to a halt. So we, and then, you know, what happens when the economy goes bad is violence, yeah, and the crime will go up. And I kept thinking about the kids getting older and wanting to drive and go places. And so all of that made us have a family reunion and discuss, hey, maybe we need to get back to plan A because this was plan B.
Plan A being North Carolina, ultimately, for Annabel Rosa, who is chair of the Durham Mayor's Hispanic Latino Committee, a member of the Governor's Advisory Council on Hispanic Latino Affairs, and an attorney. Just ahead, we'll talk about the work she does now in Latino communities in North Carolina. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest, Annabel Rosa, an attorney in North Carolina, grew up in Puerto Rico, has spent over half her life in the mainland U.S., tried to go back to the U.S. territory to live with her family, but it was a difficult place to live. Eventually, she came back to North Carolina, and that was our gain. She is with us now. We talked about Spanish-speaking communities being many and varied across this whole country. Talk about those communities in North Carolina.
There is so much growth amidst the mood in the federal government. Or nationally, but there's so much growth. I see it every day. There's salsa night at least twice a week around here, and shows, and you know, art shows and cultural activities for Latinos, and they're increasing. So as you see some negative things happening, there's a lot of positive as well.
And talk about your work on these. We'll talk about, I guess, the Mayor's Commission first in Durham, the kind of work you do there, and then we'll talk about what's happening at the state level.
Well, at first, working with the Mayor's Group was organizing and creating bylaws, doing all the boring work, and creating bylaws and becoming an official group. And I sort of joined the group accidentally, I would say, because I said, hey, I see that there aren't as many Latinos coming to these meetings. Do you have anyone? The mayor at that point was Bill Bell in Durham. And I said, do you need help? And he said, in fact, I want you to join this group that has been working. And actually, the city of Durham had a group working since 2002 and had won an award from the League of Cities for doing some things in the past. So there was a very active group because it was reacting to problems. And when we got together, we said, well, let's do things where we don't have to react to problems. Let's have a place where people can come and we can be a bridge and we can prevent problems. And that's what happened.
What were the challenges to organizing a group like that?
It's just mostly getting the work done, yeah, because the city was very accepting and willing and wanting. In fact, the mayor wanted the group to get together and do the work, which is, you know, make recommendations, tell us what's needed.
Us what's needed. What do we need?
Well, we had, for example, one of the problems we looked at early on was evictions, which are still going on. And they're not a Latino problem. They're a poverty problem. And for Latinos, you know, if you are of a first generation and you don't speak Spanish, you don't speak English, then you have that added problem. So you have the eviction problem, the education problem of, you know, learning, do I have to sign a lease or should I get into these month-to-month situations? And, you know, a lot of people taking advantage of people who can, they see as, you know, we can take advantage of this group. And so we saw that a lot of Latinos were being evicted along with, you know, a large group of poor folks. And there are protections, you know, fair housing is pretty active in Durham. So we got together and said, well, we don't want to reinvent a wheel. Right. So, but we found out that there were programs and joined in and helped out. And
how much of the work, like that kind of work, has to do with community education, getting into the communities and being able to explain what your rights are, having the translators around, having attorneys to work with them? And then how much of that requires, you know, city council and ordinances to be revised or passed?
I think for it's because the city has jurisdiction over certain areas, say, you know, education would be under the purview of the state and it would not go under the purview of the mayor's office. So the mayor's office is more economic development, safety, those kinds of issues, and, you know, parks and recreation. So these are the things that I had to learn when I came here too, and that we have to educate the community on. You know, what can the governor's office do? What can the mayor's office do? How can we all work together to make things better? Because right now with all the deportations and the way people are feeling about, you know, even leaving their houses or sending their kids to school, how can we educate them if they're not even willing to go anywhere? Once they get home, they just want to feel safer being home. And it's a challenge.
Well, for those who believe, particularly among those who were talking about the subset who may not be properly documented, there might be those who say, well, perhaps they shouldn't feel safe in their homes. Perhaps they would feel safer in their native country where they are legally allowed to be. So why would we make it more comfortable for people who don't have the proper documentation to be here?
Just like I said about myself and my family, if we could be home, if we could be closer to our grandparents and the rest of our families, that's where I would be. But everyone is seeking, well, for some folks, to stay alive. That's first foremost. So they have no choice. I mean, as bad as it is to get into the country and to remain with fear, they have no other choice. So, you know, if they stay home at the end of the day after being able to work, and get home, then we have to get to their homes.
And you're also on the Governor's Advisory Council on Hispanic Latino Affairs. What does that group do?
It does a similar job as the mayor's does. It's set up differently. The group seeks recommendations and puts together recommendations in the different areas. I belong in the Economic Development Group. And I just became chair of the leadership group, the leadership subcommittee. And I'm really excited about that because I'm going to be able to meet leadership, people who are natural leaders anywhere in the state. So the rural communities, everywhere. I'm going to be able to talk to those people and know exactly what are the issues there? How can we help? And I think that I chose the Economic Development Group to be a part of because I think those two link well together. If we can get these economic development programs that are already in place to get out there into these rural areas.
Well, tell us about those programs. What are they and how do they help or do they?
There is a strong program in place in the state that is looking to do exactly that. So it was a perfect timing to be able to get every other program in the state. For example, there's a need right now for people to establish companies that will build bridges. And there is education. There is financial help.
And these are not necessarily programs targeted for Spanish-speaking populations.
No.
Right? They're for the general good, but the idea is we've got a lot of people who are looking for this kind of work.
Yes, and not everyone's undocumented.
Right.
So these are programs that everyone should be looking into in order to not just improve their lives, but the lives of their communities so that they can live in the rural areas and these areas can thrive.
You know, it's interesting. You talked about the fact that localities can only do so much, that immigration, when we're talking about that as an issue, is really kind of a federal issue, and localities have only so much jurisdiction. And then you find our state, at least the state legislature, the House has passed a bill that both its critics would say impinges on federal authority and also local authority. So it's way out of bounds, the critics would say, that would force sheriffs. The Sheriff's Association has fiercely opposed this legislation. Sheriffs don't like it. But the legislature seems to think that it wants to impinge even on what the localities can do. I mean, I wonder what the sense in the community is. What's your sense of that kind of legislation, the effect of it?
Well, before I talk about that, I think also it would be interesting to see how it will work out. How will it play out legally? You know, what will be the legal implications of all of that, because at first it has to go to the governor. The governor has the...
And it hasn't been to the Senate yet, we should point out, but go ahead.
It has to go to the Senate, and then if it passes there, which it probably will, it will get to the governor, and I believe he'll do the right thing with the bill. But then if it becomes law, you know, what are then, you know, there will probably be lawsuits and we'll see what happens with that. But I think that, you know, the result in the psyche of the community is that it is even more scared, because regardless of how the deportations happen, they have gone up by a huge number. And people are already scared. So if they're going to have to deal with ICE being on the streets and near the schools, or, you know, where people live and work, or they're going to be at the detention centers.
Well, and this is what local law enforcement has complained about, and why the Sheriff's Association opposes this particular legislation that would force compliance, cooperation with the detainers program, is that it makes it much more difficult for law enforcement to police their communities. It makes it less safe in those communities for everybody if law enforcement can't do their job, hands tied because of this compulsion. And you're telling me, you're seeing this, that this is what happens. People go behind the wall and they don't cooperate.
It chills cooperation from the community. We hear from, you know, in the mayor's group, we have a number of police officers who come and represent the sheriff's office at these meetings, and the mayor's and the city of Durham. And they both have told us that if the community is afraid, they are not going to come and cooperate in criminal investigations.
Let's get back to Puerto Rico for a moment. It's been a year and a half since Maria, and there was just a piece in the New York Times yesterday about how slowly the progress is moving forward and how difficult things are on the island still. What do you know?
Well, the last thing I heard was the governor of Puerto Rico visiting the Washington, D.C., and getting into sort of a fight of words with the president.
Just might happen. That's happened before with visitors,
I think it was a Twitter fight. So that's what I've heard, that Trump is blaming the government of Puerto Rico, and the government of Puerto Rico is blaming the Trump administration.
There is something to that. There has been a problem with corruption on the island. That is one of the issues that we face among many, but that is an issue, is it not?
Yes, I have to say that even though I cannot agree with the Trump rhetoric regarding the reasons why aid to Puerto Rico has been slow, and I cannot agree with the way that there has been a undercount of the deaths, and I cannot agree with many of the reasons that I've heard stated for. And the reason why I say this is also very personal. I mean, my own mother's application for FEMA was denied, and her appeal was denied, and she gave up on that. Mm. So, you know, seeing the need, you know, at least we can help my mom. And, you know, but there are people who are still having those blue tarps over their homes. So I cannot agree with any of that rhetoric. However, I have to also say that there has been a lot of corruption in Puerto Rico, and that there has to be accountability. There's so much work to do in Puerto Rico. Right now, Puerto Rico is being run by a board. It's not really run by the government alone.
Well, which is to say there are ways around this. When it got to the point that administration, it seemed to have to be taken out of local hands for a time, and as you say, being run by a local board, but not the way things had been organized in Puerto Rico, there are ways to deliver aid when you know that there are problems getting the pipeline to deliver to the people who need it. That doesn't seem to be taking place. Tell me about your mom now. How's she doing?
My mother is great.
Yeah.
My mom was raised at a time, you know, she was born in 1934. She just turned 85. And she keeps up a good spirit about everything. She's still hopeful after all of this. So even though she was denied, and even though her retirement fund is depleting, and she doesn't know if she's going to have a retirement check next month.
Would she ever come here?
No. Mm. She will not. Unless she told me recently that if another Maria is announced, this time she will get in a plane.
Well, we can't be hoping for disaster,
no.
Even if it would bring you and your mom together. Anabel Rosa, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anabel Rosa is an attorney in North Carolina, also the chair of the Durham Mayor's Hispanic Latino Committee and a member of the Governor's Advisory Council on Hispanic Latino Affairs. You can find out more about her and our show at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.